Art in Our Time. Art in Our Time. You are invited to listen to a special feature program in which you will hear a talk by President Roosevelt. The occasion is the 10th anniversary of the Museum of Modern Art. The museum is opening a great new building, is presenting a new exhibition, and is inducting its new president, Nelson Rockefeller. With President Roosevelt as the principal speaker, we will hear Mayor LaGuardia, Nelson Rockefeller, Edsel Ford, College President Bob Hutchins, Edward Bruce, famous turfman Jock Whitney, Walt Disney, and Lowell Thomas. Music by the Concert Orchestra, Dr. Frank Black conducting. And now you hear the modern electronic carillon. People will be talking about the Museum of Modern Art this summer, talking this way.
Say, what is this museum anyway?
It's the museum of the present day. Art in our time. A dynamic museum.
Well, where is it?
On 53rd Street, just west of Fifth Avenue.
The new building and exhibitions are just in time for the World's Fair visitors to see.
Yes, they'll be flocking to the building with glass walls on 53rd Street.
What'll they see there?
200 modern paintings from all over the world. An outdoor sculpture garden.
Have they got any architecture?
The biggest exhibition of low-cost housing ever held.
What about photography?
There's an exhibition of famous photographs.
Got any movies?
Yes, a film library presenting a history of motion picture art. New show every day.
That's what people will be saying this summer. And at this moment, Dr. Frank Black is conducting the NBC Orchestra in one of the modern contributions to the art of music, Stravinsky's Firebird. Here's the official opening at the auditorium of the Museum of Modern Art. The museum's new president, Mr. Nelson Rockefeller.
Ladies and gentlemen, we now open this new building of the Museum of Modern Art and present to the public the new exhibition of Art in Our Time. Mayor LaGuardia is here. You all know him for his effectiveness in government and what he has done for New York City. He is devoted to the arts, was born to music. At an army post at Prescott, Arizona, his father directed a United States Army band. The mayor of New York was reared in the far West, completely American. And though the old country tradition of art has enriched his life, no one appreciates more vividly the spirit of modern times. So who could better speak for the public than the mayor of the city of New York, whom I now introduce, Mayor LaGuardia.
Mr. Rockefeller, may I, as mayor, and on behalf of the people of the city of New York, extend to you and through you, Mr. John Rockefeller, Jr., appreciation for this contribution to our city. The Museum of Modern Art takes its place permanently among the important institutions of our city. This Museum of Modern Art is somewhat different than the general run of museums. Here will be housed all kinds of works of art, not only pure art, but applied arts, not only pictures in gilded frames or statues on ponderous bases, but the applied art to make the home more beautiful, to make our parkways and streets more attractive, to make our offices and shops and factories more cheerful, in fact, to make things more beautiful and life happier. Here, the artist will have the opportunity of testing his ability, of exposing his work to the scrutiny of the critic, whatever he may know. But what is more important to the test, the general admiration or approbation of the public itself. This indeed is a distinct and useful contribution. Here, as history of art time will be recorded, provisions have been made elsewhere for what we are doing in industry, what we are doing in finances, and what we are doing in government. But here will be the repository of what is being created in the arts. Perhaps we're too close to it to appreciate it. Perhaps it requires a more distant perspective. But at least here is the opportunity that all of our time may see what is being created, our contribution to the future. This home of modern art, this hope of the contemporary artist. Thank you, Mr. Rockefeller.
Thank you, Mayor LaGuardia. And now on with the news. The 10th anniversary program of the Museum of Modern Art is news. That makes it something for Lowell Thomas to tell us about. And here he is, Lowell Thomas, to give us the news slant.
Good evening, everybody. Maybe I am the right one to give you the news slant, because so much about art is news to me. I'm the perfect layman, just asking what it's all about. Why not let the news story develop with a plain news interview? I'll interview the museum's new president, Nelson Rockefeller, here. And I suppose the first thing to ask him is, why has he become the president of the Museum of Modern Art?
Well, let me ask you one, Lowell. Why are you the manager of that softball team, those nine old men?
Well, today, the less said about that, the better. I suppose it's because I like playing ball in a feeble sort of way.
Well, so do I, and in just the same way, I like streamlined trains and automobiles, mural painting, sculpture, photography, architecture, posters, fashions, motion pictures.
I see. Add them all up, and you have modern art.
Exactly. and I'm interested in the things that make modern civilization and the American machine age better looking. And so I like to visit the Museum of Modern Art and see those things there. It's an adventure, and so many other countries are represented, it's almost like taking a trip around the world.
By the way, how many of these traveling exhibitions of modern art that we hear so much about does the museum keep on the go?
Just now, 24, and they're one of the best things we have. I also like the film library, preserving the history of the movies. It's a great thing. I like the service the museum gives its nationwide membership, the publications, the bulletins.
In other words, Nelson, you like the Museum of Modern Art. And then, I do understand that your mother, Mrs. John D. Rockefeller, Jr., is a founder of the museum.
Yes, she was, and it's one of her greatest interests today.
So naturally, there is plenty of reason for your becoming the museum president.
Lowell, I'm going to have a good time this summer, along with the World's Fair visitors who come to our 53rd Street show to see the collection of paintings, the housing show, and stroll through the outdoor garden of sculpture or watch those early movies.
You'll have fun seeing other people having fun with modern art.
That's the first purpose of the museum, to enable people, enable everybody, to see and enjoy the things that present-day artists are doing.
By the way, Nelson, do you remember the story of a modern masterpiece of sculpture, and there was an argument about paying duty on it to get it into this country?
I know the story, Lowell, and it's true. There's no duty on a work of art, but there is on imported metal. The museum was bringing in Brancusi's sculpture called Bird in Space. It was so modern, such complete simplicity, that the custom house wanted to charge us duty on it merely as a piece of metal.
Incidentally, is that Bird in Space in this present show?
It is. It's here. In fact, it was the subject matter of the Museum of Modern Art's first television broadcast this afternoon.
And there's another modernistic masterpiece that I'm curious about. Among all those weird, incomprehensible creations of the Surrealist school, there was one that impressed me the most. That fur-lined teacup. How is that marvelous, controversial work of art getting along? I heard that the moths got into it.
Well, there was a report, Lowell, that the moths had gotten into the fur-lined teacup. But to tell you the truth, it's just an ugly rumor.
Ah. That takes quite a load off my mind, Nelson.
Yes, there's nothing to it. We take good care of the works of arts entrusted to us. The very best of care.
Well, I'm sure, of course, you do that.
But really, Lowell, those extremely modern things are a part of modern art, though they're only a part. Our purpose is to show the public the best that American and foreign artists are doing today.
And tomorrow, you'll show what artists will be doing tomorrow.
That's it. The Museum of Modern Art represents the art of the past 50 years, a dynamic museum. There are plenty of splendid institutions that show the arts of the past, other ages than our own. The aim of our talented director, Alfred Barr, is to keep the museum always up to date.
You mean get people used to their own time, this time, artistically speaking, I suppose. Make them acquainted with this, the present.
Surely. We can admire and love the past and enjoy it, but we're never really a part of the past.
So you, in terms of modern art, want to give people a chance to say hello to today. Well, have you any problems? If so, what's your principal one?
Well, there are two principal problems, Lowell, two main difficulties. One is that so many people feel they should like the things that they think are highbrow. They feel it's their duty to enjoy them. Often an unpleasant duty.
An unpleasant duty to enjoy? That sounds just a bit ghastly.
Well, it is. And it scares people away from works of art. The other difficulty is the old American notion that one should not enjoy artistic things. The belief that to enjoy painting and sculpture is not the way of he-men and plain folk.
But isn't it an old primeval trait of human beings to create beautiful things and beautify their surroundings? It certainly is natural and practical for any man to be concerned about modern things for his house, his office, the modern automobile he drives, the modern merchandise he sells, or the modern factory that he operates. I suppose you might call it every man's creative art.
And by the way, Lowell, don't forget the women of this country. They do so much of the work of beautifying the surroundings in which we live.
Everybody likes to live in a world of good appearance. It certainly makes us all feel better, doesn't it?
Yes, and as the modern machine age gets better looking, we'll like it better. We'll be happier, more contented. The Museum of Modern Art is trying to help interpret the new ways of art to the people, so the people may apply those new ways of art to their lives and make their surroundings more attractive.
Well, folks attending the World's Fair, countless thousands of them, will naturally visit the Museum of Modern Art here on 53rd Street, and then they'll take home some new ideas.
We feel they will.
By the way, Nelson, I understand that the museum works extensively in collaboration with the federal government. Would you mind telling us about that?
I'd like to, but there's someone here who can tell us a great deal better than I. He's Edward Bruce, chief of the Section of Fine Arts of the Treasury Department. Mr. Bruce, won't you give us the Washington slant?
I will say this, Mr. Rockefeller. As chief of the Section of Fine Arts of the Treasury Department, I have never asked for the cooperation of the Museum of Modern Art without receiving it wholeheartedly. The first exhibition ever held by a government art agency in this country, the former Public Works of Art Project, came to your gallery for exhibition. Ever since that day, I have felt grateful for your cordial support, especially grateful for your able young director, Mr. Alfred E. Barr. We have the good fortune to be working together in a period of growing appreciation. The outstanding individual in providing the needed stimulus is none other than the President of the United States, whom you will hear later in this program. Without his belief in the civilizing power of art, there would be no Section of Fine Arts. Under President Roosevelt's administration, it has been possible to enrich our federal buildings with mural paintings and sculpture. It has been possible to offer to the American artist, on the basis of open, anonymous competitions, judged solely on merit, opportunities which are positively inspiring. No more democratic and no fairer method of giving commissions to a nation's artist has ever been evolved. However, I am not here to praise the work which I direct. I am here as chief of the Section of Fine Arts to offer you my congratulations for your great achievement and for the happy ending of your first decade of activity.
Thank you, Mr. Bruce. Now let's go on to another important slant, the value of modern art to industry. That's of timely interest, and so I'll ask Museum President Nelson Rockefeller about it.
Let's ask Edsel Ford. He's right here. He's a trustee of the museum and has a particular interest in the application of modern design to industry.
Well, the name of Ford certainly means industry. So, Edsel Ford.
Well, I look at it this way. The objects industry offers for sale are not always beautiful. I don't wish to boast in this artistic company about the beauty of the automobile, but it is designed for contemporary use entirely and is without the inappropriate patterns of ancient handicraft. The time has come when we are ashamed to copy styles inherited from the past and imported from abroad. America today is a leader and not a follower. Modern industries can turn our innumerable examples of handsomely designed modern objects, which will be as representative of the best taste of our own epoch as the objects of Greece and Rome were of theirs. One of the purposes of the Museum of Modern Art is to help you perceive the beauty in useful, well-made things. One of its exhibitions now on tour is called Useful Objects, under $5. I think the time is not far away when it will be possible for all of us to live in homes furnished with objects of museum quality, even though their cost be trifling.
You've given us a pleasant vision of the future, Mr. Edsel Ford. And now, a pleasant musical interlude. George Gershwin was a collector and a member of the advisory committee of the museum, and he lent some of the finest paintings that he owned to the museum's exhibitions. So it's fitting, surely, that we should hear an excerpt from George Gershwin's brilliant opera, Porgy and Bess.
Thank you.
There's one man here whose interests surely are varied. John Hay Whitney, director of many corporations, who probably is best known as the sportsman so prominent in affairs of the turf. And Jock Whitney is also chairman of the board of one of the best-known Hollywood motion picture companies. Moreover, he originally sponsored and is now the president of the Museum of Modern Art's Motion Picture Film Library. So I'll ask Jock Whitney to tell us about his interest in this film library.
Well, I feel that modern art is not confined to painting and sculpture. The liveliest visual art of the 20th century is the motion picture. So we have a film library, and John Abbott is doing a fine job directing it. It contains hundreds of motion pictures of every type made since 1895, representing the birth and aesthetic development of the medium which has reflected and influenced the world during the last 40 years. It has been possible to achieve this only through the cooperation of the film industry throughout the world, and it is now my pleasure to switch you to Hollywood and introduce a master of the motion picture art who has always been a warm friend of the film library, Walt Disney in Hollywood.
Thank you, Jock. It was only 4 years ago that there was considerable talk about the real need for this film library, and tonight it's an accomplished fact. My congratulations. I believe at the time it was said what a profound tragedy would be if the record of motion pictures was lost to posterity. Tragic to posterity or tragic to us? For the human critter just naturally can't swallow the thought of himself and life's work passing into oblivion completely. I understand that's why those kings of Egypt built their tombs, the pyramids, to last forever. And the fascination of the past has drawn millions to the pyramids for a look. But think how much more interesting if we had motion picture records of the actual building of the pyramids. If we could see and hear those old kings buried. And how exciting it would be to watch Nero fiddling while Rome burned. Well, our film library will be on the right side of the ledger there. Think of the knowledge we'll give posterity. The way we talk and dress and act, and the ladies' hats especially. And perhaps 1,000 years from now, or some far time when our world is ruled by tolerance and reason, posterity will delve into these old film archives of today and see great cities ruled by gangsters, see the insane savagery of war, and perhaps the world will be so changed that our tragedies will seem strange, unbelievable, incredible. And that will make posterity feel superior. A very pleasant feeling. Another gift from us. At the very least, our film library will have contributed an accurate human record of a few years in the time of man. The history of us as recorded in the history of motion pictures.
That history of motion picture began just 50 years ago in a wooden shed, a laboratory, in West Orange, New Jersey. The room is darkened and two men take turns at peering into a large wooden box, somehow illuminated from inside. The larger man of the two, rugged and hair already gray, turns away from the peephole and shakes his head.
No, it's not right. It's not good enough.
Yeah, but Mr. Edison, we've never had clearer images. Of course, they're jerky, but they move.
Yes, but they move too slow. Now, if we could photograph something that happens too quick to be seen and break it down into each separate stage... Oh, but then even if we get that far, what's the use of having pictures without the sound that goes with them? Nobody'd ever buy a box like this just to see things.
Well, it's new and it's...
Yes, so's the bicycle. But that gets you somewhere. Now, Fred, the trouble is I invented the phonograph first, darn it. I don't see any way of making these pictures jibe with my phonograph.
But maybe people won't think of them together. If you can find some exciting subjects, maybe they'll be content just to see a picture.
Fred, did you ever hear of people going to concerts and sitting in a room away from the orchestra? No. It's not going to excite them unless they can hear it. I don't think people will ever... Sometimes.
Thanks.
By golly, Fred, you're a pretty funny sight yourself right now. A sneeze. People sneeze too quick to see themselves. Say, maybe they'd pay to see a sneeze go slow.
Well, how do you mean?
Well, it happens too quick. Maybe they'd like to get a good look at the way it's done.
Oh, pardon me.
Don't apologize, Fred. I think you've saved the business.
Ten days later, Thomas Edison transferred to a cylinder a spiral of microscopic pictures of each stage in... In the magic sneeze of his assistant, Fred Ott. Ott was the first moving picture record. Within a year, Mr. Edison's little boxes, kinetoscopes they were called, were sold in thousands around the East. Wealthy families bought them and, like the inventor and his assistant, took their turn at the peephole.
But, Mama, look, it moves.
No, let me look. You've been hogging that thing a whole minute.
Wait, let Mommy look first.
Tain't fair.
All right, Selfish, come on, then. We'll try and look at it together.
Ouch.
Ooh, you goop.
That's dandy. This thing's supposed to be a Christmas present, and all I get out of it's a cracked head.
So in time, they got around to the idea of throwing these flickering pictures on a screen large enough for a family to see. In Paris, Louis Lumière, an enthusiastic photographer, invited 100 men into a basement to see a public showing of motion picture. It was a strip of film a few minutes long. It showed a French railroad station. He turned out the lights, and the audience sat tense. Way off at the end of the line, they saw a rising puff of smoke. A train started toward them, and as it came proudly into the station, that first French audience waited for no more. They started in panic for the basement steps. But one day, at the turn of the century, in a fun palace in downtown Pittsburgh, two men, one in hardware, the other in real estate.
Listen, Joe, I tell you there's money in it. The people have paid good money to sit together and look at these things.
Not a hope, Harry. It's a novelty. It's like straight front corsets or Dewey did it buttons. They won't wear forever. They're mad about it for a year, and then you're in the workhouse.
I tell you, it's an infant industry. It's like the theater.
Say, did you ever hear of a cinematograph actor?
No, but you will. Look at it this way. If you want to see Maud Adams, you have to go to New York. This Mademoiselle Bernhardt, she's had to come all the way across the ocean. By Jiminy, if this thing catches on, we can send pictures of Sarah Bernhardt all over the world, and she can stay in Paris, France, or wherever she has a mind. Why, these new actors, they'll be gods, sort of like the Greeks have.
Harry, you have elegant visions, but you lack practical viewpoints. I'm putting my money into these bicycles. Now there's the coming industry. Come on, let's have some lunch. You're going to need it.
But Harry was right. They showed pictures and barns and mission houses and old basements. They made a story out in New Jersey about a train robbery. And across 3,000 miles of America, crowds fought to see it. The movies were as real as life and twice as fresh. In 1905, Harry Davis opened in Pittsburgh the first motion picture theater. Within 5 years, every big town on two continents had a movie theater and a pianist switching from Tchaikovsky to the Rosary at the drop of an actor's tear. Within 10 years, nations that had never heard of Musset or David Garrick had discovered a common idol.
He's wunderbar! He's colossal!
Gee whiz, he's funny!
On the contrary, I think he's really dashing amusing!
Mon Dieu, have you never heard of Charlot? My friend, you are behind the time.
Oh, Signor, look! Charlie Chaplin!
Up in Boston, Massachusetts, a man who had traveled the country to find a banker to back him.
Oh, it's impossible, ridiculous. I'll be a laughingstock. $100,000 for a single picture.
Yes, that's it exactly. We'll try the Italian system. Over there, they have one picture, one show. The picture will run for 2 hours.
Yes, and your audience will be sleeping at a price of $1,000 a minute. $100,000. Why, you could finance the Civil War for that money.
The money was found, and it financed no war. But up in Boston, at the first showing of a film that dramatized the Civil War, 20,000 people battled for 2 hours with police. The whole world flocked to see The Birth of a Nation. And the feature film set the pattern of movie entertainment. Then the miracle happened. At last they showed pictures you could see and hear. And the movies came alive for 200 million people a week. What started out in New Jersey as a man's face puckering into a sneeze had grown to be the greatest convulsion in the history of entertainment. At the beginning, the only way they knew how to show movement was to photograph moving things. And the movies have kept to their first principle. They kept moving until one night in New York, 1,000 people lined up for hours on wet pavements to hear the greatest star of the movies open her mouth and say aloud for the first time,
I love you.
Soon they told stories. They filmed the world's literature. They took the world's actors from France, Japan, and America, and Sweden, and England. They became audible newspapers, and opened up the sights and sounds that happened yesterday in a busy world.
The eyes and ears of the world.
The news and review.
The march of time.
They told the story of Camille and Snow White and what hats were being worn in Paris and San Francisco. They caught history on the wing and gave to millions what otherwise only a few thousand heard anxiously in a square in Berlin.
On this day break, my rock is ready.
They made a drawing board come to life and gave voices to swans and dogs and mice. And today, in many a suburban home, men and women think of the old days.
I remember my father bought me one of those things you looked into. Oh, you know, I forget the name. Gosh, I'd give anything to see John Bunny again.
Who was he, Father?
Way before your time, daughter. Now, there was a comedian.
Well, if he was as good as Charlie Chaplin.
I'd still like to see John Bunny. And Valentino. And Pearl White. And Eddie Polo.
And so, in New York, he could. The Museum of Modern Art Film Library has collected films that cover the entire history of the movies. Every week, copied reels go off to schools and colleges throughout the United States, teaching the development in the art of the motion picture telling and showing the public life and private fantasy of 40 years of the Western world. The movies have shown storms at sea and the war and peace of five continents, the birth and life of fishes and flowers, the movies. The once despised pastime of loafers in flea circuses have skimmed continents and taught living geography, followed the skill of surgeons and given back that skill to students on a screen. They have been all things to all men and become for our time the modern minstrel, the teller of folk tales, the teacher, the eyes and ears on how the other half lives, the eavesdropper on history in the making.
Next, the educational aspect of modern art, and President Robert Maynard Hutchins of the University of Chicago. His wife is a well-known sculptress, and Bob Hutchins tells me that Mrs. Hutchins has given him most of his ideas on art. He's particularly interested in the educational value of the traveling exhibitions sent out by the museum. So let's switch to Dr. Robert Maynard Hutchins, speaking from Chicago.
The Museum of Modern Art is doubly burdened and doubly privileged. Beauty is an idea. It is also a subject matter. It appears symbolically and democratically in the plastic arts, in music, and in poetry. Beauty, which is an abstract thing, may therefore be demonstrated. The Museum of Modern Art is a place of demonstration. It follows that the Museum of Modern Art is a place of action. A university, on the other hand, is a place for study, contemplation, and decision. Aesthetics, or the philosophy of art, is an important subject matter which no one will deny should be contemplated in a university. Perhaps the reason it is contemplated so inadequately now is that it is too difficult. The Greeks left the subject relatively unexplored, perhaps because they considered an artist no different from a shoemaker. It appears that it is hard for us to think without the Greeks. The Museum of Modern Art is going ahead without the help of the universities and without the Greeks. It has recognized its double burden and its double privilege. It is making decisions about beauty as well as displaying beauty. It is attempting to teach people how to understand art. It knows that it is not enough to have exhibits. People have eyes and perceive not. Perception can be taught. Perception is understanding. Now it is accepted that the Museum of Modern Art is a good thing and a pleasant place for the artist who produces and for the potential artist who appreciates. But it is to the third and largest group, which we may call the common people, that the Museum of Modern Art is especially important. I include in the common people kings and presidents and privileged persons. In Paris, the authoritative Beaux-Arts magazine noted that the present Queen of England had purchased a painting by Augustus John. the Beaux-Arts added, this was the first occasion since before the reign of Charles I, 300 years ago, that the British royal family has acquired a picture solely for its artistic merit. The portraits in the White House are distinguished by their subject matter. It is in the homes of our friends that we see the worst chromos. It is to the third group of rational beings, then, that the Museum of Art is most important. Because they are rational, they want to know, to perceive, to understand. When they do know through the work that the Museum of Modern Art is doing, they will cease to be impatient and sometimes rude about modern art. The Museum of Modern Art is doubly burdened and doubly privileged.
The program continues from New York.
Again we hear Dr. Frank Black directing the orchestra, and the composition is the Casanova Ballet by Deems Taylor.
And now, once more, we will hear from Lowell Thomas.
The new building of the Museum of Modern Art has been opened by the new museum president, Nelson Rockefeller, and a new exhibition presented to the public. It's the 10th anniversary of the museum, and the emphasis has been on the relation of modern art to this changing 20th century world of ours. We're gathered here in the new museum building, which in itself is an achievement of modern art.
It is, I am told, the first public building to be constructed according to the latest principles of utilitarian architecture. This building of glass is a striking sight here on 53rd Street, just west of Fifth Avenue, and it's sure to attract the interest of visitors to the New York World's Fair during the summer. The Museum of Modern Art in New York, with its traveling exhibitions that tour the entire country, is an institution of national consequence. That's the dominating thought as the celebration of the opening now comes to its climax. And you will hear from the museum president, Nelson Rockefeller.
No, Lowell, we will hear the President of the United States. He will tell us about the importance of art and cultural freedom to a democracy. There was another President of the United States who directed this nation in critical times, Abraham Lincoln. And President Lincoln spoke these words: "Let us live to prove that we can cultivate the natural world beneath and around us, and the intellectual and moral world within us, and secure an individual, social, and political prosperity whose course shall be forward and which, while the earth endures, shall not pass away." Lincoln was president in an epoch when the arts of this nation were still in the pioneer stage. Franklin Delano Roosevelt presides at a time when American art has crossed the threshold of a new era. And now we switch to the White House in Washington. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
President Rockefeller, friends of the Museum of Modern Art, when men dedicate a new edifice for a common enterprise, they are at once celebrating an achievement and announcing a purpose. They cannot refrain, nor could they properly be excused from making clear what that purpose is. From all that has been said by the speakers to whom we have been listening tonight, the mission of this museum is plain. We are dedicating this building to the cause of peace and to the pursuits of peace. The arts that ennoble and refine life flourish only in the atmosphere of peace. And in this hour of dedication, we are glad again to bear witness before all the world to our faith in the sanctity of free institutions. For we know that only where men are free can the arts flourish and the civilization of national culture reach full flower. The arts cannot thrive except where men are free to be themselves and to be in charge of the discipline of their own energies and their own ardors. The conditions for democracy and for art are one and the same. What you and I call liberty in politics results, in the long run, in freedom in the arts. There can be no vitality in the works gathered together in a museum unless there exists the right of spontaneous life in the society in which the arts themselves are nourished. A world that is turned into a stereotype, a society converted into a regiment, a life translated into a routine, make it difficult for either art or artists to survive at all. If you crush individuality in society, you crush art as well. If you nourish the conditions of a free life, you nourish the arts also. In encouraging the creation and enjoyment of beautiful things, we are furthering democracy itself. And that is why this museum is a citadel of civilization. As the Museum of Modern Art is a living museum, not a collection of curious and interesting objects, it can therefore become an integral part of our democratic institutions. It can be woven into the very warp and woof of our democracy. Because it has been conceived as a national institution, the museum can enrich and invigorate our cultural life in every home by bringing the best of modern art to all of the American people. And this, I am gratified to learn, will be done through the traveling exhibitions of this new museum. It is most important that the museum make these traveling exhibits an essential part of its work. By this means, the gap between the artists, on the one side, and American industry and the great American public on the other, can be bridged. And most important of all, the standards of American taste will inevitably be raised by thus bringing into far-flung communities the results of the latest and finest achievements in all of the many arts. These traveling exhibits are going to extend the perspective of the general public, which too often has been accustomed to think of the fine arts as merely painting or merely sculpture. But the proposed traveling exhibitions and nationwide shows will make all of our people in the big communities and down into the small communities increasingly aware of the enormous importance of contemporary industrial design and architecture of all kinds of buildings, homes and public buildings and business buildings and every other kind of building, and will include the great social art, housing, which by its very nature is one of the most formidable challenges to a democracy such as ours, and will include as well such arts as photography, the printed book, the illustration, the advertisement, the poster, the theater, and the moving picture. Thus, a nationwide public will receive a demonstration of the force and the scope of all of these branches of the visual arts, things that you and I can see with our eyes. Art in America has always belonged to the people. It has never been the property of an academy or of a class. The great treasury projects through which our public buildings today are being decorated are an excellent example of the continuity of this tradition. The federal art projects of the Works Progress Administration is a practical relief project to take care of people who otherwise would starve, a relief project that also emphasizes the best tradition of the democratic spirit. The WPA artist in almost every state and county of this community is rendering his own impression of things. He's speaking also for the spirit of his fellow countrymen throughout the nation. And so I think that the WPA artist exemplifies with great force the essential place that the arts as a whole have in this democratic society as of ours. In the future, we must seek more widespread popular understanding and appreciation of all of these arts. Many of our great cities provide, of course, the facilities for such appreciation. But we all know that because of their lack of size and their lack of riches, the smaller communities are in most cases denied this opportunity. And that, my friends, is why I am giving special emphasis to the need of giving to these smaller counties and communities the visual chance to get to know modern art. As in our democracy, we enjoy the right to believe in different religious creeds or in none at all, so can American artists express themselves with complete freedom from the strictures of dead artistic traditions or political ideology. While our American artists have discovered a new obligation to the society in which they live, these artists have no compulsion to be limited in method or limited in the manner of their expression. The opportunity before this museum of modern art is just as broad as the whole of the United States. I trust that the fine example that this institution is affording will be widely copied throughout the land, and that the good work will continue until the influence of the best and the noblest in the fine arts will permeate every community in the nation that we call the United States.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have heard the President of the United States speaking from the White House in Washington. We now return you to New York.
This is the 10th anniversary ceremony of the Museum of Modern Art, the opening of the new museum building at 11 West 53rd Street, and the presentation to the public of the new exhibition of art in our time. Dr. Frank Black will close this program directing the orchestra in his own arrangement of a piece of music truly representative of art in our time, Old Man River from Showboat.
Thank you.